Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Round of applause for Jeff.
I have one request for Jeff.
Yes.
The next time he does that, he needs to record it for us.
No recording.
Who couldn't make it?
I'm preaching. There's no recording.
The popular consensus, Jeff, is that you should have recorded it. And I genuinely, deeply appreciate the flood, the outpouring of love and cards and phone calls and the email that I got. I should get sick more often because I found out how much I'm loved. I got sick. I laid down for a week. But, you know, Monday morning, boy, the emails all come in like, well, where are you? Where's the message? What are you doing? So I immediately got on my blog and had to write, and I'm sick, back off. And so then Jeff preached. He didn't record it. It's Jeff's fault.
Give him his email address?
Yeah, and then give them Jeff's email. By the way, jeff@salvationbygrace.org. The same way you can reach me, jim@salvationbygrace.org. You can reach Jeff at jeff@salvationbygrace.org. And you can write to him and say, next time, record it, Jeff. And that should take the weight off me. All right. Tomorrow's Valentine's Day, huh?
Uh-oh.
And I don't really plan to talk much about Valentine's Day except to give you a brief history, just so you know. But then I want to make a general observation here. Valentine's Day started back in the time of the Roman Empire. You're aware of that? No?
No. I thought Hallmark started.
Hallmark started Valentine's Day, exactly. In ancient Rome, February 14th was a holiday in honor of Juno. Juno was the queen of the Roman gods and goddesses. And the Romans also knew her as the goddess of women and marriage. Oh, you can see the connection already, can't you? And the following day, February 15th, began what was called the Feast of Lupercalia. And the lives of young boys and girls were strictly separate in Roman society. However, one of the customs of the young people was something called name drawing for that Feast of Lupercalia. And on the eve of the Festival of Lupercalia, the names of Roman girls were all written on slips of paper and put into jars and then taken to the little boys, and the little boys would draw the name, and whatever girl's name was on that piece of paper, you were stuck with her for the whole Feast of Lupercalia. And that was sort of the beginning of the romantic connections to February 14th and 15th. But then under Emperor Claudius II, Claudius the Cruel, that was the nickname he got, Claudius II, he was having a difficult time enlisting men into his army. So he concluded that the problem was that young men were all falling in love and getting married. And so he outlawed all new marriages and all new engagements in his empire so that he could have more men entering his army. Well, during that time, there was a fellow in the Catholic Church, Valentine, a Saint Valentine. He was later sainted to be called Saint Valentine. At the time, he was just a priest named Valentine, who supposedly would marry these folks in private anyway. If they wanted to get married, he would perform what was really an illegal wedding. Why did I have the trouble saying illegal wedding? But anyway, illegal weddings he was performing, and then the emperor found out about it and had him killed. And then the story kind of grew from there to a legend that also said that while Valentine was in prison, he fell in love with his jailer's daughter, and that he would send her little notes and cards and stuff, and that they were signed "From Your Valentine," and that is the beginning of the notion of "To and from Valentine, will you be my Valentine," that kind of stuff all grew from that. So that's kind of the root of it. Now, I only bring that up because there's a theological thing to be considered here. I'm seeing, and you're going to see a lot of it the next few days this week as they replay next weekend services that are being had in churches today. Last night on TBN, I don't know if any of you happened to tune into TBN last night. I'm a glutton for punishment. They had their entire set decked out in red and pink streamers with red and pink hearts and arrows and little Cupid things, and they had tables and chairs everywhere with all these couples, with all the women in red dresses and the men in suits, and they had, you know, a little band playing in the corner, and they were singing love songs to each other, and they were really playing up romantic love on their set to celebrate Valentine's Day. But then the preacher did what you're going to hear so many preachers in America do today. And like I said, over the course of this week and next weekend, as today's services play on the television sets, you're going to see them all justify them talking about Valentine's Day and romantic love and marriage and commitment and stuff. And they're all going to quote one verse. What is it? God is love. They're all going to say, and I can justify doing this and decking out all the Valentine Roman pagan stuff on my stage because, after all, God is love. And this is a really common, very important mistake that people make. Do not ever confuse the love of God with romantic love. Those are two completely different things. The love of God is an utterly sacrificial love that has nothing to do with the kind of love that Shane and Elizabeth share. It's a completely different kind of love. We don't need you to testify. Let me give you an example. See, human beings are not intrinsically capable of God-type sacrificial love. Let me give you an example. David's my friend. I've known David more years than I want to count. 10, 12 years?
Maybe 13.
Okay. Known David for a long time. We were both younger, we were both hipper and cooler when we met.
I've never been hip and cool, so.
Okay, so. Okay, me either.
Yeah, it was you, Jim.
And so,
yeah, that was me.
Oh, that was Tom. I'm sorry. Now, as much as I love David, if David gets in really bad trouble, let's say he gets in trouble with the law, David does something. I mean, something bad. David does something bad. And he has to go in front of a judge for what he did. There is the possibility, perhaps not a probability, but a possibility that if the judge was to say, okay, but David, if somebody else will serve your sentence for you, I'll let them serve your sentence. There's a possibility that I would step up and say, I really love David. I'll go to jail for him. I'll pay the price for him. There's a maybe in there somewhere, but if David and the judge both said, Jim, how much do you love David? And I say, I really love David. And they say, okay, how about we send your son James to jail in David's place? See, Elizabeth's already shaking her head. I'm already going, well, see, I love David a lot. And but see, James doesn't deserve it. And David does. So there's an intrinsic unfairness to the notion that David shouldn't serve his sentence, while my son, who is in fact innocent of David's crime, should serve it. And yet the love of God went so far that it would say, okay, my son will serve it out, who doesn't deserve it. But that's still, that analogy still doesn't do it. We got to go even further than that. We got to go to somebody who's a stranger, who doesn't know me and who doesn't know James, who in fact is hostile to me and James, who doesn't like us, doesn't love us, doesn't care about us, doesn't know us, would rather we stay out of their life. And they commit some heinous, murderous rampage. And while they're at home in their living room watching TV, eating Cheetos and drinking beer, the cops show up at their door, and I show up there with my son, and I say, take my son instead. Don't take that guy. He's a guilty, murdering, beer-drinking, Cheeto-eating, TV-watching guy. Don't take him. Take my son instead. And they take my son, and they lock him up for life for what this guy did, and he doesn't even know it. He's inside, totally unaware of what we just did for him. And finally, when he does find out the price that was already paid for him, and he feels bad about it, feels guilty about it, comes out to me and says, what have you done? You've put your son in jail on my behalf. No, I need to right this wrong. I'll go. I'll admit it. I'll say I'm wrong. I'm guilty. I say, too late. They've already committed the death penalty. My son's already dead for you. The price is paid, and you're free now, and there's nothing you can do about it. You're free. That's the kind of love God talks about. When it says God is love, we're talking about a sacrificial type of love that loved you long before you ever knew him, when you hated him. Herein is love, says the Bible. Not that we loved God, but that he first loved us and gave his son to die. That's love. We were God-hating, rebellious, Cheeto-eating, TV-watching sinners. I was just trying to draw the correlation to the guy in the house. Who didn't want God, didn't love God, didn't care about God, could give two flips about God. While he was killing his son on Calvary for you, for your crime, for your guilt. That kind of love. God has... Pardon me?
In Romans, while we were yet sinners,
God has commended his love toward us. Exactly. God has commended his love toward us. He has shown us the example of his love, commended it to us, as if God needs to commend his love to us. Let me give you a recommendation here. My love. He has commended his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That's the kind of love I'm talking about. Now, you cannot equate that kind of sacrificial love that does what is good for the one being loved, whether you get anything back or not. That's what agape means. The Greek word agape that talks about the love of God, even the Greeks in their language had to stretch the language to try to find an explanation for the type of love that God exhibited in the death of his son. And so they end up with this word agape that means in its essence that you love so much that you do what is good for the one being loved, whether they recognize that it's good or not. Whether they want it or not, whether they hate you or not, you know it's for their good and you love them so much that you will risk being hated by them to do what is right and what is good and what is beneficial for them. And that's very different than romantic love. And what has happened in the church these days is that they've taken that concept, God is love, and they've turned it around and said, and love is God. The Bible doesn't say that. The deification of love is wrong. But all love exists because God is love. We can't have, as human beings, this is just basic philosophy, we as human beings can't have any positive characteristics that God didn't first have. Do you understand what I mean? There's nothing good about us that wasn't first good about God. We couldn't possibly be better in any aspect than God is. Know what I mean? So any positive characteristics we have, like love or faithfulness or honesty, truthfulness, even humor, none of that could be human characteristics if God didn't first have those characteristics. And that's the point of John writing, that God is love. The highest attribute of human beings is to be loving, and all that that means, sacrificially loving. But we didn't start that. We didn't begin that. We don't sustain that. It's not in our human flesh to be that kind of self-sacrificially loving. It has to be God who is love, showing his love through us. But it is God who is love. But love is not God. The deification of love has then got guys like Dave Hunt writing books. What Love Is This? The Norman Geisler book, Chosen But Free is Geisler. And What Love Is This is Dave Hunt, where he starts with the idea of romantic love and says God is love and then defines it romantically and then says, what sort of love is this that God would put people in hell? Why, that's not loving. A loving God has to want everybody to come to him, and he couldn't allow anybody to suffer because he has misappropriated the notion of love and turned it into, oh, I love you so much. Oh, God just loves everybody so much. He loved Pharaoh so much that he raised him up for the very purpose of drowning him and his army in the Red Sea. What a loving God. See, if you start with the premise That God is just all big, mushy, marshmallow, romantic, red roses and flowers love, then you can't allow him to act like he acts in the Bible. But the fact of the matter is that the God of the Bible has discriminating love. Now remember what I just said. There is no characteristic that human beings have that God doesn't have much more, or have first, or have primarily. You with me so far? We humans know enough to know how to discriminate in our love. Right? Right. Here, this is going to be fun. Hang on. So, Valerie.
Oh, no.
Do you love Scott? Okay. Love Scott. We've established this. Love Scott. Okay. This is Dave. Do you love Dave?
Sure.
Okay. Do you love Dave the same way you love Scott?
No.
Why not?
Oh, poor Dave.
Do you need a hug?
Yes, I'll never be the same.
I know. Why? Because you discriminate, right? He's a single man, he's a single man. But you have a discriminating kind of love that says, yes, but I love this one more than I love that one, right? Okay, Kaylee is a teenage girl in the back of the room. This is Megan. She's a teenage girl sitting in the room. Charlie is a nearly teenage girl sitting in the room. Okay, how old are you now, Charlie?
11,
okay. We've got these three girls sitting in the room and a couple others in the back. How old are you?
13.
You're 13, okay, good, good, good. So we've got three teenagers in the room and one almost teenager in the room, okay? I love Megan in a way that I don't love the other three. And nobody and nobody faults me for that. Nobody says, well, Jim, you really haven't treated the other three the way you've treated Megan. Megan's got a new fancy blouse on that Dad paid for. Why didn't the other three get one? Not fair. If they went to their mom and dad crying, Pastor Jim didn't buy me a blouse like he bought. The answer would be, well, he's not your dad.
Exactly.
Right? That's the answer.
Exactly.
Well, he's not your dad. Why do I love her more? Why do I love James more? Because they're mine. You getting this? And yet people will argue that God is not allowed to exercise the same sort of discrimination in his love that nobody in the room had a problem with when Valerie said that she loves Scott more than Dave. We all went, well, sure, fine, naturally. We're all okay with this. I said, I love Megan more than I love the other three girls in the room. And everybody went, of course. And then the Bible says God loves his elect more than he loves the others. And people go, no, no fair, no, won't have it, no. Just couldn't be. It ain't right. It ain't fair. It's fair that I love Megan. It's fair that you love Scott, but it's not fair that God love his own. Not fair. But there's no characteristic that human beings have that God didn't first have. Which means if we have the ability to be discerning in our love, then certainly God has the ability to be discerning in his love. Did he love Pharaoh as much as he loved the children of Israel? No, he saved the children of Israel and he drowned Pharaoh and his army. You can't say that that is the same type of romantic marshmallow love. It's two completely different kinds of love.
Yeah, but God was converted to the marshmallowy kind of love in the New Testament.
There are people who think that. I think, yes, he was the angry God in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament now he's... He had a son, and now he wants everybody to come to him. Except that the son walked around saying things like, why don't you understand my speech, even because you cannot hear my words? Why? Because you're not of my sheep.
You brood of vipers.
I'm so loving. How will you escape the fires of hell, where the worm never sleeps and the fire is never quenched? I love you.
Be my Valentine.
Yeah, be my Valentine. Do you understand that? Do you see the difference? So as you see people this week trying to create Valentine messages and use God as love as their method for doing it, Understand that what they've done is they have deified one characteristic of God, which is his love, made it his primary characteristic, and then redefined him through that filter. There's a book that Arthur W. Pink wrote called The Attributes of God. If you have an opportunity, read it. In his book, he very clearly spells out a central point that I think the vast majority of Christendom has forgotten. He talks about not only God's characteristics, but his primary attribute. And in the modern church world, people assume that the primary attribute of God is love. And they make that the attribute through which all other attributes flow. In other words, all of his other attributes are modified by that primary attribute. Know what I mean? Pink is very clear to spell out that his primary attribute is his holiness, and that all other attributes flow from his holiness, which is why we can talk about God's holy love, which is God's love modified by his holiness, but we can equally talk about his holy wrath. That makes sense to us, that God's holiness demands that his righteousness and his justice be satisfied, because he is primarily holy, and his holiness demands satisfaction. And we can talk then about holy wrath, because holiness is that primary attribute. It is impossible, if you say that love is his primary attribute, it's impossible to talk about God's loving wrath. That makes no sense at all, that God in his love is going to destroy the world in fire. Out of love. Send people to hell out of love. That makes no sense. But his holiness is absolutely capable of both saving his elect with his holy love and condemning his enemies in his holy wrath. Because holiness is God's primary attribute. And if you read the Bible with that aspect in mind, then the characteristics of God all line up much better than if you read it through that filter that says God is primarily love, all love, and then you find these passages where God acts in very unloving ways. And so you end up having to write books like What Love Is This, where you desperately try to get away from the fact that God acts like that and explain away God's election or foreordination or predestination, because that just wouldn't be loving. Well, it doesn't have to be loving. It has to be holy. Do you get that? God is under no obligation whatsoever to be loving to his entire creation. He only has to be holy in his whole creation. And if he opts to be loving to Dave, he can be because God is love. But if he opts to condemn people and put them in hell forever, he can, because it's equally written, our God is a consuming fire. And both of those attributes equally serve his holiness, his primary attribute. So don't be confused with ideas of romantic love and then try to stamp romantic love on God. He can't be defined that way. Good enough? All right. Let's turn to Luke 16. Luke 16 is where we got to. Last time we were together, we went through Luke 15, the parable of the lost sheep and the parable of the lost coin and the parable of the lost son, the prodigal son. And the audience at the beginning of chapter 15 is spelled out very clearly. Publicans and sinners to hear him. And then there were also Pharisees and scribes in that group, murmuring against him. And he spoke these parables unto them. Chapter 16 is a continuation. Remember that there are no chapter and verse in the original letter from Luke. Chapter 16 is a continuation of this exact same story. It's still Jesus speaking to publicans and sinners as well as Pharisees. Now this next parable that he's going to tell has been more widely and wildly interpreted than I think any other parable in the Bible. This is a really difficult one for people to deal with. But here's the key to understanding this first parable in chapter 16. Look down at verse 14. Verse 14 says, "The Pharisees also who were covetous heard all these things, and they derided him. And he said unto them, You are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knows your heart, and that which is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God." That's a summary statement. So whatever else we're going to say about this parable, we have to understand that it was pointed enough at the Pharisees that it really made them angry and they derided him for it. So that helps us to understand who the object of this parable is. He's clearly saying this to the Pharisees, and he said it to them in such a way that it really made them angry. And you'll see when he wraps it up. Now go back a couple of verses. Verse 10. "He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. He that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much." Again, that's his summary statement. Whatever else we get out of this parable, we have to understand that that's Jesus telling us what this parable means. Okay? Then he's going to say in verse 11, "If therefore you have not been faithful in," the King James says, "unrighteous mammon." It just means money, the money of the world, the money of unrighteousness. "If you haven't been faithful with unrighteous mammon, then who will commit to your trust the true riches?" Verse 12, "And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own?" Verse 13, "No servant can serve two masters. For either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Mammon, unrighteous mammon. So whatever else we get out of this parable, we have to know that that is Jesus' summary statement of what the parable's about. Okay? Now let's read the parable. Chapter 16, verse 1. "He said also unto his disciples, There was a certain rich man, which had a steward. And the same," the steward, "was accused unto him," that's the certain rich man, "that he," the steward, "had wasted his," the rich man's, "goods." So there's a third person in that verse. You've got a rich man, you've got a steward, and you've got somebody who came to the rich man and accused the steward and said, "The steward is not treating you fairly." Steward is like a manager, money manager of the house. Very good, thank you. In the old days, if you had a large household, and in these days too, if you have a large household, and you have a lot of butlers and maids and stuff, you'll have like a chief butler who runs the household, who has a certain amount of money that he works with to make sure that there's always food and supplies and everything in the house, and he's in charge of that budget for the house. And that's what this guy was. He was the steward of the house who had access to his master's money and his master's power, and his master had a lot of debtors, and he was in charge of keeping up with all those debts. So he basically was a money manager for a rich man. So, verse 2. "He," that would be the rich man, "called him," the steward, "and said unto the steward, How is it that I hear this about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you may no longer be the steward." In other words, you're going to be fired, but after all, you run my business, and I don't know anything about my business. I don't know who owes me what. So in order for me to hire a new steward, I'm going to have a full accounting of where we stand right now. Who do I owe? Who owes us? What have we got? So you give me an accounting of your stewardship, and then you're fired. So here's what he does. Verse 3. "Then the steward said inside himself," or within himself, "What will I do? For my Lord taketh away from me my stewardship. And I cannot dig, and I'm ashamed to beg." In other words, I can't do manual labor, and I'm too proud to go beg for money, and I'm going to lose my job. What am I going to do? By the way, I also have to point out at this point, in the King James, and in probably in other translations you've got, they use the word Lord a lot in here with a lowercase L. Jesus is also going to use it. The word is still used the very same way in the English language over in England, where we do have a a queen and a crown and a throne. We just don't have it in America, so you don't hear the word lord much. But if you had a large manor and you had a lot of people who worked the land, the people who worked the land worked for the lord of the manor, and they were called the serfs. And to this day, the king, Charles, when he's crowned king, will be called my lord. And whenever they gather all together, the people who have magisterial titles, they call them lords and ladies. That's the way that the word lord is being used here in the King James. So when Jesus, in a minute, says lord, that's where a lot of people get confused and think, oh, lord there, that means God or Jesus. And it doesn't. It just means the rich man who was the lord of the manor. Got that? Okay, don't get confused. So the steward said within himself, what'll I do? For my lord takes away from me my stewardship. I cannot dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I am resolved what I will do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. Hang on to that phrase. It's a very important phrase because Jesus is going to close the parable with that exact same notion, that same phrase. What the steward has decided is, okay, I'm going to be put out of this guy's house. I don't want to beg and I don't want to dig. What I need is a new gig. I need a new job as a steward. But everybody's going to figure out that I got let go from my stewardship because I wasn't honest. So I'm going to have to curry favor with some other people who are rich, who have big houses. I know what I'll do. He puts a plan in place so that when he's put out of this house, he'll be welcome into another house. Even if he's not welcomed in as a steward, he's at least going to have a job somewhere else. Here's his cunning plan. Verse 5. So he called every one of his lord's debtors unto him, and he said unto the first, how much do you owe to my lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said unto him, then take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. See what he did? Very clever. Said, okay, I'm going to need a job when I leave here. You and I know what we just did. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You owe 100. Say you owe 50. I'll tell my master that you owe 50. And you're off scot-free for 50. Now, when I'm on the street, remember, you owe me. Verse 7. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said unto him, take your bill and write 80. 80. And the Lord, now this is where people get very confused. Look at verse 8. Now the rich man, apparently, there's a jump in time here. The rich man found out what had happened. The rich man figured out how clever this guy was when he brought his accounting. And the Lord, the rich man, commended the unjust steward because he had been wise. He'd been cunning. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser or more cunning than the children of light. Now that's the place where people go into a certain amount of apoplexy because it sounds like Jesus is saying, if you say Lord there, it appears that Jesus is commending the guy who had acted unjustly. And I've seen several interpretations that way where they have to work very hard to get around the fact that Jesus has just said that this guy was wise. More wise than the children of light, but that's not really what's happening here. What Jesus said was in the parable, the rich man recognized how shrewd his manager had been. But it wasn't God that approved it. And then Jesus makes the comment that the children of this world are more sly, more cunning than the children of light, which is a good comment. You would want it to be that way. You would want the children of light to be more honest, to be more forthright, to be less cunning. Got the picture? So the Lord in the parable commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. And I say unto you, this is a difficult one, look at verse 9. I say unto you, make to yourselves friends from the mammon of unrighteousness, that when you fall or when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. Now here's what we know about that verse. We know that Jesus just said, use money, worldly money, unrighteous mammon, in such a way that you make friends, such friends as will welcome you when you die. And they'll welcome you into everlasting habitations. Depending on your translation, there's a couple different ways that the failure there is interpreted. Some say that it's the money that failed. Some of your interpretations will say that it's the person that fails. It's not real clear in the Greek what the object of the failure is. It may say when the money is all gone. It may say when you die and you're all gone. Either way, the object that Jesus is saying is use unrighteous money in such a manner like the unjust steward did. What did the unjust steward do? He used unrighteous mammon, money, trading, to make friends so that he'd be welcome in another house when he was put out of the house. Jesus then draws the parallel and says, now you use money in such a way that when you're put out of the house, leave planet Earth, you have friends who will take you into everlasting habitations. You'll be welcomed into heaven, into an everlasting home. So here's what we know so far, and admittedly, there's plenty of details here that people can twist and contort and confuse. But what we know for sure is he told a parable where he said there was a guy who was not a just man who used unrighteous mammon for his own benefit. And then he said, because the children of this world are more clever, more cunning, more shrewd than the children of light. And then he says, so here's what you need to do. You need to use money, unrighteous money, the money of this world, the mammon of this world, in such a way that you gain friends that will welcome you everlastingly into everlasting habitations. So he's saying there is a way to use money in this world at this time in such a way that it will lay up a heavenly reward for you and people will welcome you when you get to heaven. All of that's clear from what he has said here, right? Any confusion yet? Okay. Now the question is, who is he saying that to? Because if you interpret that in such a way as to say Jesus is speaking to Christians there, after all, it's Jesus talking, and everything Jesus says, he says to his church, and everything he's saying to his saints. If you're saying that he's teaching a lesson there to Christians, to saints, to the church, then you got to go, okay, now, I guess he's saying, give money to the church in such a way that you make friends who, I guess, die before you, and then when you get to heaven, because you gave them money on earth, they'll welcome you when you get to heaven, and that, there's an interpretation right here in the notes of my Bible. This is the Zodiades Bible I've got up here, and in his notes, because he starts with the assumption that it is written to Christians, he says the point of this parable is that Christians are supposed to forgive. Because after all, the unjust steward went around saying, what do you owe? Well, then write this. And he started forgiving debts. And the point of the parable is to say that we're to forgive, which makes no sense to me at all, because this guy was forgiving only 50% and 20%. So if we're going to follow that example, Dave, I know you wronged me, and I forgive you a good 20% for what you did to me.
It wasn't really his debt either.
And it was for his benefit.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't his debt to start with, exactly. So that interpretation makes no sense. Now again, remember where I started. The people who were most offended by this parable was the Pharisees. He is saying this to the Pharisees. He's saying this to the legalists. Jump ahead again. Let me show you one more thing. Here's another key. Verse 16. After he has already said to the Pharisees, you are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. The law and the prophets were until John the Baptist. Since that time, the kingdom of God is preached and every man presses into it. And it is easier for heaven and earth to pass than for one tittle of the law to fail. This is all still in the same context. So this helps. That gives us a lens from which to look at this whole parable again. Think about it in terms of Jesus speaking it to Pharisees. It offended them, and it has to do with keeping the whole of the law. If that's the case, then the Lord of the manor is, in fact, the rich man who has a steward, is God. And the steward in that case is the Pharisees, which is why they got so upset about it. And they, who were supposed to be defending God in his law, instead, in order to curry favor with other men, remember what he just said, that which is favorable among men is an abomination before God. In order to curry favor with men, we're walking around saying, yeah, I know you didn't really keep that law, but, you know, you grease my palm, we'll forget about it. Do you give me a little extra, a little money, line my pockets, we'll just forgive you for that one. Rather like the idea of selling indulgences, which is what made Luther so upset. If you knew you were going to have a wild weekend, you just go to the church early, pay up, and then your sins are already forgiven before you even do it. That was the whole indulgence idea. The lawyers, the Pharisees, were going to people and saying, I know you owe God 100%. Write 50. I'll tell him 50. Make it 80. I'll tell him 80. Because they actually believed that they sat in the seat of Moses where they had the right to fudge on the law a little bit and to forgive sin, to cover things up, and to not follow every detail of the law. This makes much more sense now. If God is the Lord who deserves a full accounting from his stewards who are the Pharisees, you can see why God would then say, I'm going to put you out of the house. Because that's exactly what Jesus always told the Pharisees. You don't go into the kingdom and you don't let anybody else in. And you compass land and sea to try to make one proselyte, and when you find him, you make him twice the child of hell that you yourself are. That's the way Jesus talked to them. So it's very in keeping for Jesus then to create this parable and this story where he's saying, you're going to be put out of the house. And then he says, because the children of this world are more cunning than the children of light, which means he drew a distinction between the children of light, those that were his, and the children of this world, and he included the Pharisees in it. And you can see why the Pharisees would be upset about that. That they had used the temple of God as a place to exchange money, to make themselves rich, which is why Jesus went in twice during his ministry and drove out the money changers and said, my temple will be a house of prayer, and you've made it a den of thieves. This false religion that had been raised up by the Pharisees was constantly wheeling and dealing and trading the same way that the world did. And God is going to throw them out of the house for that. And they understood the point of the parable. Jesus then says to them, he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. That's an indictment now. Do you feel it? When he's talking to the Pharisees and he says, look, you've already started fudging on the law, since I've already used that language. You've already begun trimming down the law, but not one tittle, not one. Do you know what that word means in our language? There's my name, Jim. The little dots over the eyes, when he said not one dot, not one tittle, it's where we get the word dot every I, cross every T. And Jesus said, not one dot, not one tittle, not one cross will be gone out of one little mark, every little mark in the language of the law. He said, not a bit of it's going to fade away until it's all fulfilled. And it's all going to stand against these Pharisees, and they're going to say, oh, well, we did it 50%. Oh, we did it 80%. And not only did we do it that way, we taught others to do it that way. And we told him it was okay. And he says, yeah, well, if you're faithful in little, then you're going to be faithful in much. But if you're unfaithful in little, the jots and the tittles, then you're going to be unfaithful in the whole thing. He that is faithful in that which is the least is faithful in much. He that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. If therefore you have been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, in the handling of money, were the Pharisees in fact faithful in their handling of money? No, of course not. That's why Jesus burst in and overturned the money changers' tables in the temple. Because they were using religion as a way to enrich themselves. Hold on. Yeah, they were using religion as a way to enrich themselves. And turning the temple of God, which is supposed to be a house of prayer, into a marketplace of merchandise. Modern Christianity. Very much like modern Christianity, yes, where every church you go into has stuff for sale, things you can buy. Paul said, don't make merchandise of the church. And they had plenty of merchandise. You go to the temple in those days, there was merchandise galore. And in fact, they wouldn't allow you to just use the common money. You had to exchange it for the temple money. And then in the exchange rate, they would keep a little back. That was the temple tax. And instead of you having to bring the best of your flock, like the law said, you bring the best of your flock and you sacrifice it before God, you could just bring some money and you could buy from the herds and the flocks they kept right there at the temple. So you didn't have to go through that extra trouble of doing it the way God said. You get there and they'll sell you an animal, which may have a blemish or two. It's no big deal. God doesn't mean do this exactly. God's talking in big roundabout terms. And so you exchange, you buy, you get yourself a poor animal, you sacrifice that to God. And they thought that this was all fine because they were getting rich and they were essentially basically doing more or less what God said. They just weren't doing it 100%. They were doing it 50%. They were doing it 80%, but not the whole way. And teaching others to do it that way. If therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, then who will commit to your trust the true riches? In other words, you're not going into the kingdom. You're not going to go to the place where the real riches are. And why would God ever commit it to you? Because look, you couldn't even handle the unrighteous mammon of this world. If the unrighteous money of this world causes you to stumble, what makes you think that God is going to trust you with the wealth of heaven, is his question. If you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, the whole religion given to the Pharisees is God's religion and the worship of God. He said, this isn't even yours to mess with. And if you haven't been faithful in that which belongs to another man, then who's going to give you anything that is your own? If you can't be a faithful enough steward to God to handle the things of God, what makes you think God's going to give you anything of your own? Because it all belongs to him. So then he wraps up, verse 13, no servant can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. And who reacted? The Pharisees, look at verse 14. And the Pharisees also, who were covetous, heard all these things and they derided him. Which is why I believe that's the correct interpretation of that parable. It's because of the reaction of the Pharisees. Those are the people he directed it at, and those were the people most offended by it. And there's no way to fit that parable into a mold for Christians, even though I have heard many giving messages that use those verses and say, well, now if you can't be faithful with the unrighteous mammon, you can't be faithful in heaven. Or they'll say, you know, use the unrighteous mammon, use the money, give the money to the church. There's plenty of good giving passages in Scripture. There's plenty of places in the Bible to preach giving. That's not one of them. What this is about is Jesus one more time deriding the religious leaders of the day. And don't forget the larger context, according to Luke, is that he's on his way to Jerusalem at this very moment. And when he gets there, he is going to overturn the temple one more time. And on his way, every time he runs into the Pharisees, he angers them until they deride him, until they hate him all the more, because he has a date with the cross and he's got to be on it. And so he's making sure, because he is, after all, in complete sovereign control of absolutely all the events leading up to and all the way through his crucifixion, so he's making sure that there are people there angry enough to do it. And all the way along, he's making sure to judge them. By the way, this is one of the other examples, as long as we're here, one of the other examples of the difference between you and Christ. I just had this conversation with someone the other day. The WWJD thing came up again. What would Jesus do? This conversation. And I said, it's the wrong question. What would Jesus do? That's the wrong question. The question is not, what would Jesus do? Because the answer is, heal the sick, raise the dead, you know, die for the sins of all his people. That's what Jesus would do. You can't do that. So you don't base your life on the question, what would Jesus do, as if you're the substitute for Jesus, walking around doing the stuff Jesus would do if he was here. You can't do that. The right question is, what would Jesus have you do? And then that's what you do. He's your Lord, you're his servant. What would Jesus have me do? It's the proper question. What would Jesus do? He's doing it. There was never anything Jesus would do that he didn't do. He's actively doing it. So erase your little armbands and write in, what would Jesus have me do? Makes much more sense. Now, the point here is that Jesus is not you and you are not Christ, and don't ever get the two confused. Jesus walked around saying, don't judge, lest you be judged. And yet here he is one more time to these Pharisees, just judging the fool out of them. Judging them one more time, looking right through them, getting to their heart and telling them and condemning them and telling them they're not going to heaven, they're not going to be in the house and they can't escape hell. Judging like mad. Why? Because you're not him and he's not you. He can say to you, don't judge, and then he can judge. Why? Because he doesn't follow the rules he puts on you. You're a sinner. You can't see through people. You don't know people's heart. It's not up to you to judge anybody. But it is up to him to judge people. And he will ultimately judge everybody. Because he's not you, and you can't do what he could do. And this is another one of those examples of the difference between Christ and you. So, let's wrap up here. And the Pharisees also, who were covetous, heard all these things, and they derided him. And he said unto them, you are they. There, now he's directing it. Now you know who the parable is pointed at. You are they that justify yourselves before men. But God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. Let's talk about that for a moment. They wanted to be justified before men, which is why they put on their fancy robes and they made their phylacteries wide and they had the borders of their garments very wide. And when they would make a prayer, they'd stand up in front of everybody and make a long prayer to be seen of men. And when they would give any money in the temple, they would make sure that there were trumpets blown so that people would say, oh, look at that very holy man, that Pharisee giving money up there. And Jesus derided all of that kind of activity that they did because he said, they have their reward. They want to be seen by men, and now that men have seen them, they have their reward. They have no reward in heaven for what they have done. And then he said, now you, when you pray, you go into a closet and you pray in secret to your Father who hears in secret. And when you give, you don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. The contrast between the way the Pharisees did it and the way you were to do it is all the way through Jesus' ministry, that they would pump themselves up and want to be seen by men. But they got their reward. They were seen by men. But look how much further Jesus goes with it. He then goes the rest of the way and says, but God knows your heart. And listen, those things that seem precious to men, the praise of other men, oh, I'm the high, important, mighty one, look at me. He said, that's not just wrong, that's an abomination before God. Should I apply it? Sure, let's. You turn on the TV, flip over to TBN, or any number of other stations, and there's a guy or a woman there with a Bible, decked out in their finery. And what is with some of the suits these guys are wearing on TBN these days? Stuff that they would never be seen dead in the mall with. But, you know, if you're up on the platform, boy, it's become just a replacement for the snazzy robes that the Pharisees used to wear. They've just put on the $1,000, $1,500 fancy suits. And then strut and pose and posture and yell and carry on until the crowd is cheering for you and you're touching people and they're embracing you. And the guys, I saw a guy do that the other day on the platform. That's a Michael Jackson pose, just, you know. What is that guy doing? Is he honoring God when he does that stuff? Who is he trying to honor?
Wallowing in his own pride.
And you know what? Jesus just said, that is an abomination. Do you get the sense of that word, abomination? We'll be done in a minute.
Hatred, right?
Absolute hatred. Hatred by God. Completely hell-bound, impure, can't be in the presence of a holy God, abominable. And God says that kind of activity in a religious setting designed to make people pay attention to you and get their focus off of Christ, off of God, off of what is right and holy, off of the genuine faith, and get their focus on you, is an abomination before God. And they don't just have platforms now. They have platforms with their name on them. The Joyce Meyer Ministries. Not only am I completely anti-biblical by the very fact that I'm standing up here in front of men preaching, being a woman, but I'm going to cram my name on every single thing I sell. And then you can have it in your house, and you can put it on the front of your Bible, the Joyce Meyer Study Bible, and you can have the Joyce Meyer stuff, and send me the money on Joyce Meyer Ministries, and the Joyce Meyer International Fellowship, and the Joyce Meyer, Joyce, 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 Joyce. When you go to one of those things, when they show up here in Nashville, are people going there to worship God, or are they going to see a celebrity?
They're going to be entertained.
They're going to be entertained, and they're going there to see Joyce. Now, I'm just picking on Joyce because she's an obvious example, because she puts her name on it. But I don't care if you use Jimmy Swaggart. His name's on everything. I don't pick a name. Everybody's got their name on everything. Jimmy Swaggart didn't graduate high school. He's got the Jimmy Swaggart University. There's an education. I don't care who it is. If they're putting their name on it, see, fortunately, you all are smart enough, you're wise enough, you're in tune enough, that if the sign out front ever changed from Grace Christian Assembly, where thank God if I'm sick and I fall down, there's a man in the wings who can stand right here and the church continues and the worship of God continues. And my presence here is secondary to whether or not God shows up. If God shows up here, we're fine whether I show up or not. But if everybody gathers downtown to see Joyce and they say, Joyce can't do it today, her assistant Cleo will be talking. I'm making up Cleo. People are streaming for the doors. I didn't come to see Cleo. I came to see Joyce. I'm out of here. Beat the traffic out of here. No. And you all are wise enough that if I change the sign out front from GCA to Jim McLarty Ministries, I'm standing here by myself the next week. And that's how it should be. Because I say over and over, this is not the gym thing, this is God's thing. This is God's church, God's building. It's all dedicated to the work of preaching this gospel. And if I walk out here today and get hit by a truck, God will raise up another man right here, give him the same gift, and this work will continue. Because this work is about the proclamation of the gospel of Christ, and it is not about me, my ego, my pride, or how cool Jim is. As Dave pointed out earlier, we both stopped being cool a long time ago. An abomination. Don't lose the weight of that word, is my point. Jesus can say that kind of man-pleasing, egocentric activity is an abomination, and yet that does not stop it from running rampant in modern Christianity. Did I say anything the Bible didn't say? Okay. With the exception of saying the word Joyce Meyer, which is not in the Bible anywhere. The only place you find Joyce Meyer in the Bible is, I will not have a woman to teach or usurp authority over a man. That's the only place you find Joyce in the Bible. Just thought I'd point it out. Okay. Verse 16, the law and the prophets were until John the Baptist. Since that time, the kingdom of God is preached and every man presses into it. That's a very interesting phrase. That's basically him saying, you Pharisees think that by pushing, by pressing, by your fleshly attempt, that you're going to push your way into the kingdom of God. And he's saying the law and the prophets, that period of what we call the Old Testament, ran until John the Baptist, that he was the last of what would be considered Old Testament prophets. But from that point forward, he says the Messiah is here and the kingdom of God is being preached and every man tries to push his way in, press his way in through his efforts. But what does he say? Verse 17, it is easier for heaven and earth to pass away than for one tittle of the law to fail. In other words, you're going to be judged by that very law, being the Pharisees. You're going to be judged by that very law you're attempting to keep. Which law is going to keep you and all your children out of the kingdom? That's what that parable means. We comfortable with that?
Yep.
Okay, now we're going to pick up next week with verse 18. It is still in that same context. He is going to continue to condemn them on the basis of divorce because the Pharisees were very flippant in their attitudes toward divorce. And so we're going to talk about that next week, and we'll talk about divorce as a subject next week. And we'll look at Old Testament and New Testament teaching and take that on as a subject for 1 week. So that's why I want to stop right where I am. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Is there anything wrong with Cheetos for real?
It's an abomination.
Cheetos are an abomination.
Only if you mix them with beer.
This is only your second time visiting. No. And with that comment, you just fit right in. So,
on behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.